to open a new chapter in bilateral ties. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi earlier this week said that both countries have maintained communication through diplomatic and military channels, and both are committed to upholding the stability in the disputed border region. He expressed China's desire to work with India in the direction towards steady and sound growth of China-India relations. The statement came amid heightened tensions after paramilitary forces of the two countries clashed near Tawang in the northeastern Indian state of Arunachal Pradesh last month. Even though the situation was brought under control, the truth is that after the Galwan clash in 2020, the forces of the two countries show no sign of pulling back. It remains to be seen if the Chinese foreign minister's statement will change anything on the ground or if the status quo will remain intact.
The India-China border clashes in recent years have been the worst in over half a century, bringing the relationship between the two countries to an all-time low. While India is working to deepen its cooperation with the U.S., Beijing is hoping New Delhi might retrace its old antipathy towards the West and abstain from moving closer to the U.S. in particular. China has maintained that it will not be subdued by hegemonic powers and their bullying tactics, calling on New Delhi to join the Eastern Bloc.
Sino-India relations have hit the rock bottom in the last few years. The two Asian giants have been involved in military skirmishes along the disputed borders in Ladakh and Arunachal Pradesh on several occasions. More recently, a video emerged online of what appeared to be a previously unreported violent clash between the two armies. The video was reportedly filmed in the Indian state of Arunachal Pradesh at the line of actual control, the de facto border between the two countries. The growing India-U.S. bonhomie has not also been taken well by China. In a recent speech by the Chinese foreign minister while taking stock of China's foreign policy during the year 2022, he primarily focused on China's troubled relationship with the U.S. Wang Yi, while lashing out at the U.S., pointed to its relations with China as erroneous policy. China has also not been happy with India's membership in the U.S.-led quadrilateral security dialogue. The Quad, comprising the U.S., India, Japan and Australia, often referred to as Asian NATO, is aimed at thwarting the Chinese plans for the Asia-Pacific region. China has maintained that it is focusing on strategic stability in relation to other major countries to make the world a better place.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Chris McRain from Manchester. He's a geopolitical analyst. Mr. McRain, welcome to the program. Now, let's begin with China's recent statement to work with India for better relations between the two countries. How do you see it, especially coming at a time when the two sides recently engaged in clashes near the Indian state of Arunachal Pradesh?
I think China's main goal, as it has been for the past 30 years of development, is the progress of a multipolar world, and India is a big part of that. I know they do have a disagreement of a dispute over territory around that area. I know there are treaties in place that stop weapons being used in that area. If you see troop movements in that area, they almost look like medieval armies because they're all carrying melee weapons rather than ballistic weapons. There's no guns, so they are making some sort of steps to make peace. But a lot of this is about economic development, which is a big part of it. Obviously, one of the main adversaries in the world as it is today is almost putting the brakes on American interference. So China showing that sort of hand of friendship in aiding co-opting the Indian development together is a really big, important step, I think, and it shows a lot of maturity in the Chinese position.
Mr. McRain, how do you look at India's policy regarding China? Are there any takers for cordial China-India relations in India, or India wants to focus on getting closer to the West, especially the US seeing China as an arch rival in the region?
I think the American position very much wants it to be an arch rival. America have been caught in the government of Modi for quite some time in the hope of it being some sort of bulwark against Chinese development. You do see sometimes where it does look like it could go that way and then it somehow tethers the other. I personally don't believe it is going that way. Now, China, India is obviously a big part of BRICS, which is the development program alongside Russia and China, throughout the conflict of last year between Russia and Ukraine. India have been one of the major importers of Russian oil, which is very much sort of putting it in the Chinese sort of block, as you would. If we were talking in sort of Cold War terms, China would be now sort of appearing in the Indian sort of sphere. So I think there is a lot to work out between China and India, but I think in the end, I think economic development will come out as the number one player, and China are India's best hope at that. They're part of the One Belt, One Road initiative, which is obviously going to help a lot of developing nations in that region, which is obviously something that America don't want to see happen.
Mr. McQueen, the Chinese Foreign Minister's remarks regarding the hostile attitude of the U.S. towards the country and its impact on the world politics. Do you see any shift in the relation the two countries currently share?
I think we are in the decades of the coming war with China. America have perceived themselves as the number one for so long. Their entire identity is built on being number one, the number one military, the number one economy, and they are very close to losing that position. And I think the only, it's like a child losing its toy, it's going to lash out. And I think in the way it's going to lash out is in the form of a conflict with China. It is a conflict that I do believe that they are destined to lose. It does seem to be poised towards the territory of Taiwan. Obviously, the world are in this difficult situation with Taiwan where nobody recognises it as a country, but behave that it is a country as such. They carry on arming it, where it is, in fact, a breakaway country. It is the result of a civil war that they lost. And any other territory in the world would treat it as such. If India or Iran won a civil war against part of its breakaway section, that breakaway section wouldn't then be able to make diplomatic demands as Taiwan has been doing.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
For Kashmir, 2022 was a year of misfortunes, with New Delhi introducing new policies to integrate the region into the Indian Union. The BJP government in India continues to follow in the Israeli regime's footsteps in Kashmir in a bid to change the Muslim-majority region's demography. In the latest development, India has implemented a law that allows leasing governmental land to outsiders. This move is aimed at further disempowering and alienating the local Muslim population of the region.
Since the abrogation of Article 370 in August 2019, the Himalayan region of Kashmir has lost its limited autonomy. In the last 3 years, changing the land policies has been the prime focus of the BJP government in New Delhi. As the region doesn't have an elected state government and is directly ruled by New Delhi, the central government has time and again passed orders in the past few years to allow non-local residents to settle, work, and buy property in the Kashmir Valley. The central government's anti-Kashmir policies have led to fear and apprehension of demographic change among the local Muslim population. The rules lately introduced by the government require local traders to return the land lease from the government. According to the government order, anyone not adhering to the rule will be forcefully evicted from the property. The land can now be bought by non-Kashmiris, paving the way to establish settlements in the valley on the model of Israeli settlements in occupied Palestinian territories. Hospitality, being one of the important sectors in the state, is also facing the brunt of this policy as the government has decided to auction the properties and permits, leaving hundreds of Kashmiris associated with the sector on the brink of joblessness.
The past year has also witnessed increased persecution of journalists working in the Kashmir region. The homes of several journalists have been raided, with scores being summoned by the police. According to analysts, this move has been designed to silence the media and prevent it from publishing news deemed controversial or critical of New Delhi. This has instilled fear amongst journalists working in the region, as they have been abstaining from reporting about the politics of the region.
With media in Kashmir operating in an atmosphere of fear, the coverage of local dailies is now limited to state-sponsored events, portraying an all-colorful governmental picture of the valley. New Delhi has been resorting to tough laws such as the Public Safety Act, which incurs 2 years in jail without trial. Many journalists have been booked under this act past year. It has further terrified the journalistic fraternity in the Himalayan region, which has already been maintaining silence since the abrogation of Article 370 by the BJP government in New Delhi. According to the annual World Press Freedom Index conducted by Reporters Without Borders, India has dropped from 142nd to 150th rank in the past year. The same report calls India one of the worst countries for media persons. The situation in Kashmir is more worrisome, as reporters are harassed by the police and the paramilitary forces on a regular basis. In a bid to control and intimidate journalists working in the valley, the government last year closed the doors of the Kashmir Press Club, a democratically elected journalistic body. The Indian government has also been restricting Kashmiri journalists from international travel. A Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist was recently barred by the government from traveling to receive her award.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Munir Ahmed from Islamabad. He's a senior journalist and political analyst. Mr. Ahmed, first of all, welcome to the program. Now, how do you view the recent land rules issued by the government? Is this an attempt to change the demography of the state of Jammu and Kashmir and a bid to change its Muslim majority status?
From August 5th, 2019, Indian government is trying to change the demographic status of Muslims in Indian illegally occupied Kashmir, and the new land rules is also one of them. And since the annexation of Kashmir with India, they are trying in many ways to change the demographic position status of population over there. And certainly they have already taken several other steps as well. And they have given several hectares of land to different people living in other cities of India, and they are giving many leases agreements to them so that they could establish their own businesses in India. And land reforms, the new land reforms, quote-unquote, would certainly is an attempt to give all the land of Indian illegally occupied Kashmir to the Indian businessmen. Those resources of occupied Kashmir would being transferred to the non-locals, and that is really a terrible situation. Though the international community is voicing against the annexation of August 5, but still India is not hearing the voices of the people and voices of the locals. Though they are protesting on the streets, and they have been under curfew for around 3 years. Having curfew and changing the demographic position in Indian illegally occupied Kashmir is a right point of concern for Pakistan as well, and for the entire Muslim communities across the world as well.
Now, Mr. Ahmed, hospitality is one of the most important business sectors in the valley. The government has decided not to extend the lease of the local hoteliers and open the option of lease auction for the non-locals as well. Do you see this as an attempt to break the economic backbone of Kashmir?
Hospitality is certainly a big business for Kashmiri people, and they have been doing wonderful business, and most of international tourism in India is based on what the Indian illegally occupied Kashmir offers. They have wonderful places, lakes, and the environment they have is really a sellable commodity in terms of tourism. Now, the Indian government is giving all the leases of the hotels and all the other facilities of the tourism to non-locals. That is really a dent to the entire economy of the local. They have already given the other buildings owned by the government and the institutions, even owned by the private sector, to the non-locals over there to do businesses. And the agricultural lands, as I mentioned, has already been given to non-locals. The entire interventions by the government are mean to dent the to weaken the Muslim community living in the occupied Kashmir. And this is really terrible and against the international norms. And the people are, the local people are protesting. Surely they have reservations, and the international community shall come up to help them out. And in the wake of new Cold War, they will be having economic recession in the coming days as well. As you have seen that the economy is becoming weaker and weaker post-COVID. So in this situation, these government interventions will be killing the local economy, especially make more weaker the Muslim communities there.
Mr. Ahmed, let's talk about the mauling, the freedom of press, and also the clampdown on the journalists. Is New Delhi sending across the word that no voice of dissent can be tolerated?
Indian government has banned media in occupied Kashmir. And even they banned the visit of the international community over there, especially the UN observers. Were not allowed to go in the occupied Kashmir so that they could not observe what has been happening over there. And more than 50 journalists have been killed in the recent years. And this is quite alarming that they have canceled declarations of many print media and electronic media. YouTube channels, the web-based channels are already banned. And such kind of imposition of ban on the voice of the locals is really worrisome. I believe like this is a strangulation of the voice of freedom they are raising in Kashmir. And it should be condemned, and if you have seen last year and even in 2020, the Human Rights Watch reports have condemned all these atrocities there, and they have also raised a voice for the freedom of press over there, and engaging and allowing the other people go over there and see by themselves. But they were not allowed, and the Indian government is not even bothering by the international reports and all the protests there, the locals are carrying out. This is really strange, and I don't know what could be done to convince the Indian government to have Kashmiris their own voice.
Last but not least, sir, how do you see the future of journalism in Kashmir? Can we hope for any good days ahead, or will this atmosphere of fear continue?
I don't see any future of journalism or the business of the local Kashmiri Muslims. As the Indian government has banned all the publications and there is no internet access at all, and they also have stopped the YouTube transmissions and the access to YouTube and uploading of such kind of material over there. The journalists cannot report even to international media. If some journalists could reach out to international media or write something about the actual situation in Kashmir, they face consequences. In that context, certainly there is no future of journalism and the Muslim community over there. Again, I would urge UN organizations and other human rights organizations to put Kashmir on their priority agenda. Otherwise, the humanity in Kashmir will be suffering for all the atrocities Indian government are imposing on them.
There you have it, Mr. Munir Ahmed. He's a senior journalist and political analyst from Islamabad. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see what people have to say on social media.
Ittehad al-Muslimin wrote, "People of Jammu and Kashmir will forcefully resist every challenge by New Delhi to change the demography of the state by scrapping Article 35A. Tajammul Islam tweeted, "New J&K land laws are not in the interest of people of Jammu and Kashmir, as these will further widen the gap between New Delhi and people of Jammu and Kashmir. At BJP for India is trying to change the demography of Jammu and Kashmir, which will have serious consequences."
And that was our episode about the controversial land rules being implemented by India in the state of Jammu and Kashmir, and also the China-India relations continuing to nosedive amid simmering border tensions. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
By becoming so reliant on energy imports from the US, Brussels is effectively replacing one addiction with another, the Kremlin spokesman has said, ironically adding that in the second case, the return is much less. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT had an eye on this issue, writing, "Brussels is merely replacing one addiction with another," Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has said. The determination of EU states to rid themselves of their reliance on Russian energy also makes them slow to acknowledge their inevitable dependence on the US, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has said recently. By becoming so reliant on energy imports from the US, Brussels is effectively replacing one addiction with another, the spokesman has said, adding ironically that in the second case, the return is much less. And now when Europeans are spending billions of euros every day, these billions of dollars are being earned in Washington, Peskov said in an interview with Russian state broadcaster Rossiya. The EU has been grappling with a severe energy crisis for more than a year. The crunch has been exacerbated by the bloc's efforts to punish Russia over the crisis with Ukraine, with sanctions, and to decrease its energy reliance on the country, which was formerly its leading natural gas supplier. The situation worsened dramatically in early July, following the first disruption of Russian supplies to a number of EU countries, attributed to turbine maintenance issues due to sanctions. The Nord Stream pipeline was subsequently blown up in September, rendering it inoperable. According to National, European natural gas prices are rising as temperatures fall in the region, which is currently in the middle of an energy crisis. Dutch TTF gas futures, the benchmark European contract, was trading at 149.25 euros a megawatt hour, up 10% compared with a week ago. With exports of Russian natural gas severely curtailed, the continent has been scrambling for alternative fuel sources. Europe imported more than 11.4 million tons of LNG in November, a new record high for the year, energy consultancy Rystad Energy said. France, Spain and the UK combined accounted for more than half of Europe's total imports. The consultancy added, European countries have signed LNG import agreements with the US and the Persian Gulf countries over the past few months. Recently, the UK and US announced a new energy partnership they say will help reduce Europe's dependency on Russian gas and oil. Under the new UK-US Energy Security and Affordability Partnership, America will export at least 9 to 10 billion cubic meters of LNG over the next year via UK terminals, more than double the level of last year. Qatar Energy has signed two sales and purchase agreements with US oil and gas company ConocoPhillips to deliver up to 2 million tons per annum of LNG to Germany. In October, Austrian energy company OMV signed a preliminary agreement with Abu Dhabi's ADNOC with the aim of purchasing an LNG cargo for next winter. European countries which met their gas storage targets in late October will also rely more on their gas reserves as temperatures in the region continue to plummet. Rystad Energy said, "We expect gas to be withdrawn from European gas storage at levels between 300 and 500 million cubic meters per day. The gas market will be supported by strong LNG imports, firm Norwegian gas pipeline flows, and a stable gas supply from Africa and Azerbaijan." The EU is reportedly considering a natural gas price cap of 220 euros ahead of a meeting on December 13th. Several countries, including France and Spain, previously rejected the European Commission's proposal for a temporary gas price cap. The move to impose a ceiling on Dutch TTF gas futures would distort market signals, with potential unintended consequences for demand and supply, Rystad Energy said in a report last month. Electricity tariffs have increased in the region during higher demand for heating. The UK has surpassed Italy in having the most expensive power in Europe, with prices up 121% week on week to average €363 per MWH last week, Rystad Energy has said. According to National, Europe could face a deficit of as much as 30 BCM of natural gas in 2023 if Russian supplies come to a halt and demand from China recovers, the International Energy Agency said in a November report. The caution provided by current storage levels as well as recent lower gas prices and mild temperatures should not lead to overly optimistic conclusions about the future, the agency said. Global LNG supply is expected to increase by only 20 BCM in 2023, with about one-third of the growth coming from the US.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Sheikh Abdulaziz bin Zayed's recent trip to Damascus was the second time he met with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad as the two Arab nations continued to warm up to each other. The two top diplomats discussed restoration of relations and boosting of economic ties, with Assad saying that they will help regional stability and Sheikh Abdullah expressing support for a diplomatic solution to the conflict in Syria, as he was joined by a group of economic and security officials on his visit. Relations between Syria and the UAE were severed after Syria was expelled from the 22-member Arab League all the way back in 2011. The UAE reopened its embassy in Syria in 2018. Bahrain, Algeria, and Jordan have also resumed ties with Syria, while other Arab nations are calling for Syria's reinstation to the Arab League. This trend has not been sitting well with the U.S., as officials have slammed the visit by Sheikh Abdullah. One U.S. senator has even threatened the UAE with sanctions in a tweet in typical Twitter fashion. UAE's outreach to the Assad regime provides little benefits to the Emirates. This carries huge risks to UAE's reputation, exposes it to Caesar sanctions, and hurts efforts to seek accountability for Assad's crimes against the Syrian people. The Caesar sanctions refers to the Caesar-Syria Civilian Protection Act of 2019, also known as the Caesar Act. It is a U.S. legislation that not only sanctions the Syrian government, but also any entity, organization, or individual that provides funding or assistance to it. Iranian and Russian entities have been sanctioned under this act. It follows a pattern in U.S.'s attitude towards its foreign relations. If they don't want to conduct business with a country, no other country should be allowed to either. Sheikh Abdulaziz had criticized the Caesar Act back in 2021 during a meeting with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov. He said, bigger challenge today facing coordination and working with Syria is the Caesar Act, and further added, to keep the Caesar Act as it is today makes this path very difficult, not only for us as a nation, but also for the private sector. To those comments, the U.S. replied that it would not ease up on its stances towards Syria, a stance they have maintained to this day, as apparent by their latest remarks surrounding the latest meeting between Turkish and Syrian officials. In the first time that Ankara and Damascus held talks among their high-ranking officials since 2012, defense ministers of both countries met in Moscow at the end of December. In that meeting, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu said that he expects to meet with his Syrian and Russian counterpart later this month. This is a significant shift in Turkey's attitude towards Syria, as Ankara severed ties with the Arab nation back in 2012. And this shift has been met with a swift response from the U.S. When asked about the issue by reporters, Department of State spokesman Ned Price said, "We've made very clear to all of our allies and partners that now is not the time to normalize relations. Now is not the time to upgrade relations. Instead, in the eyes of the U.S., now is the time to impose further crippling sanctions on Syria, where the humanitarian conditions are deteriorating day by day, as the sanctions also include medicinal supplies." A UN special rapporteur on the negative impacts of unilateral coercive measures visited Syria and said that the sanctions have had catastrophic effects on the lives of Syrians as the country grapples with food and medicine shortages. She also said, "In the current dramatic and still deteriorating humanitarian situation, as 12 million Syrians grapple with food insecurity, I urge the immediate lifting of all unilateral sanctions that severely harm human rights and prevent any efforts for early recovery, rebuilding, and reconstruction." Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said on Thursday that he may meet his Syrian counterpart as part of a new peace process in the wake of the country's defense minister's meeting. An Erdogan-Assad meeting will signal the official failure of U.S. attempts to topple the Syrian government through sanctions and boycotts, as it will show that U.S. allies are no longer listening to the will of America. It will cause embarrassment for the U.S., not quite on the level of their exodus in Afghanistan, but not too far off either.
The head of the International Monetary Fund, Kristalina Georgieva, has issued a dire warning over the economic outlook in 2023, saying that this year is going to be even tougher than the year 2022. That is because the U.S., EU, and Chinese economies have slowed down. The Ukraine conflict, soaring prices, and hiked interest rates, and the rise of the COVID have contributed to the slowdown in the global economy. She also said that a third of the world economy will be hit by a recession in 2023.
For most of the world economy, this is going to be a tough year, tougher than the year we leave behind. Why? Because the three big economies, US, EU, China, are all slowing down simultaneously. Half of the European Union will be in recession next year. China is going to slow down this year further. Next year would be a tough year for China. Mm-hmm. And that translates into negative trends globally.
Back in October, the IMF slashed its outlook for global economic growth in 2023. It blamed the gloomy outlook on the ongoing conflict in Ukraine and tougher monetary policies. According to Georgieva, China will face a very difficult start to the year 2023. That's because it is likely to grow at or below global growth for the first time in 40 years, she said.
China has slowed down dramatically in 2022 because of this tight zero COVID policy. For the first time in 40 years, China's growth in 2022 is likely to be at or below global growth. That has never happened before. And looking into next year, for 3, 4, 5, 6 months, the relaxation of COVID restrictions would mean bushfire COVID cases throughout China.
She also said that the U.S. economy may avoid a recession, but warned a strong labor market there may lead the U.S. Federal Reserve to keep interest rates tight so as to combat high inflation, which could have negative economic consequences of its own. The IMF warning comes amid similar predictions by other institutions. UK-based Center for Economics and Business Research has said that the global slide into a recession next year, as a number of economies will contract due to surging borrowing costs introduced to combat inflation. K. Daniel Neufeld said, "We expect central bankers to stick to their guns in 2023, despite the economic costs. The cost of bringing inflation down to more comfortable levels is a poorer growth outlook for a number of years to come." The report is more pessimistic than the most recent forecast by the International Monetary Fund. Meanwhile, oil prices continue to slide, weighed down by China's rising COVID cases and a recession warning from the IMF. The warning comes amid a worsening economic crisis in developed nations. Just recently, Germany's Federal Statistical Office said that the country is grappling with its highest annual inflation in more than 70 years. According to official data, full-year inflation reached 7.9% in 2022 amid surging energy and food prices. The last time annual inflation was near that level was in the year 1951, when it stood at 7.6% as the post-war economic boom began. And the UK faces one of the worst recessions among the world's leading industrialized nations this year.
We're not the government. We haven't been in power for 12 years. Right, every aspect of society that's been impacted by government policy. 10 years of austerity, cuts to the economy, slowing growth, a badly handled Brexit, whatever your view on Brexit was, right, has all led to where we are today. But the fact that we've got so many people out on strike and so many people suffering, only the government can change it, or a change of government can change it.
The fallout from spiraling inflation triggered by the pandemic and the Ukraine conflict will persist for longer in the UK than in other G7 nations, and the country's recovery will be one of the weakest.
In November 2022, the Republican Party won the majority of votes to the House of Representatives. They vowed to go after Democrats and President Joe Biden, but now cracks have appeared with the party itself. In a historic incident, the GOP failed to nominate the House Speaker. Party leader Kevin McCarthy got just 203 votes in two rounds, less even than Democrat Hakeem Jeffries in the GOP-controlled chamber, and fared even worse, with 202 votes in round three. It went to six rounds, but yet McCarthy could not gain the votes. It was a tumultuous start to the new Congress and pointed to a difficult road ahead with Republicans now in control of the House. A new generation of conservative Republicans, many aligned with Donald Trump's Make America Great Again agenda, want to upend business as usual in Washington and were committed to stopping McCarthy's rise without concessions to their priorities. It is widely believed that a revolt of ultra-hardliners has dealt a humiliation to McCarthy.
Those of us who will not be voting for Kevin McCarthy today take no joy in this discomfort that this moment has brought. But if you want to drain the swamp, you cannot put the biggest alligator in charge of the exercise.
McCarthy became the first candidate to fall short in a first ballot for Speaker in a century. The impasse means Republicans are unable even to assume the control that they won in the midterms, as the new House can't yet be sworn in. The standoff over McCarthy has been building since Republicans appeared on track to win the House majority in the midterm elections in November. A new generation of Trump-aligned Republicans led the opposition to McCarthy, believing that he's neither conservative enough nor tough enough to battle Democrats.
And they even came to the position where one, Matt Gaetz, said, "I don't care if we go to plurality and we elect Hakeem Jeffries and it hurts the new frontline members not to get reelected." Well, that's not about America, and I will always fight to put the American people first, not a few individuals that want something for themselves. So we may have a battle on the floor, but the battle is for the conference and the country, and that's fine with me.
While the Senate remains in Democratic hands, House Republicans are eager to confront Biden after 2 years of the Democrats controlling both houses of Congress.
but disagreements to choose the House Speaker is an ominous sign for the party and its conservative agenda. Even if McCarthy succeeds to be the Speaker, he'll be a weak figure who may be in office but barely in power. The war, which started with the Tea Party backlash to the Obama administration, is far from over.
We will compromise, but we will not capitulate. And there's a very serious difference. There's 222 Republicans in our conference now. So if 20 people are able to drive this train however they want to, 202 of us might as well go home, because that means they are the conference. That means those 20 people will be the majority. Well, that is capitulation, and we will not do that. Compromise, yes.
The fractious support for McCarthy is over the direction of the GOP between swing district moderates and conservatives who have taken up the populist agenda of the former President Donald Trump. It is now believed that the chaos highlights the dilemma facing House Republicans.
You have 20 people demanding that 201 surrender to them unconditionally. Well, I will not surrender unconditionally. If you have conditions, give them to us. We'll consider them. Doesn't mean we'll do them, but you have to talk about them. But we've asked and we've asked, what is it you want? What do you need? But you have 20 people demanding the unconditional surrender of, including this group of warriors. We will not unconditionally surrender. Tell us what you want. We might surrender if you tell us the terms.
Analysts say no matter the concessions made to some of those on the far right, they simply will not relent and join other Republicans. The crisis is even more poignant as the party is set to brace for the presidential election set to be held in 2024. It now appears the fractures that Trump created within the Republican Party are deeper than ever before. With Trump still desperate to be elected president, it is unlikely the GOP will be able to unite behind another leader and change its electoral fortunes anytime soon. It didn't take more than a day after the most controversial and right-wing cabinet took over in Israel, headed by Benjamin Netanyahu. The UNGA acted swiftly and asked the ICJ to consider the consequences for Israel over its occupation of Palestinian territories.
Israeli practices and settlement activities affecting the rights of the Palestinian people and other Arabs of the occupied territories. End of quote.
It appeared as though the timing was pre-planned and that the resolution was a signal to the new administration. Lots of cheers from PA Ambassador to the UN on the matter, though.
This vote and request comes one day after the new Israeli government was formed, pledging to accelerate colonial and racist policies against the Palestinian people.
It came as no surprise that the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu had the complete opposite view, saying that Israel is not bound by the UN vote. But does this resolution and referral to the ICJ even make a difference where Israel is concerned, or Palestinians for that matter? Definitely not. The reasons speak for themselves. As far as the ICC is concerned, Israel is not a party to the Rome Statute that established the ICC. This is while the International Criminal Court has determined that it does have jurisdiction over the territories occupied by Israel, despite Israel's insistence to the contrary. So what is the point of all of this if it won't change the facts on the ground? Well, aside from Israel not being a member of the ICC, it disputes its jurisdiction on the basis that Palestine is not a sovereign state that is capable of being a party to the Rome Statute. The UNGA areas of focus have been issues that Israel has not heeded, nor has it even taken into account. Violation by Israel on the rights of the Palestinian people to self-determination, as well as altering the demographic composition of Al-Quds, is something that Israel has been actively doing. Not only that, coming right out of the gates, this administration has already said that it will go against the resolution. When it comes to the UN, Israel has had the most UN resolutions slapped against it, over 70 and counting. Israel has followed none. The Israeli ambassador, Gilad Erdan, has called the resolution moral stain on the UN. He said no international body can decide that the Jewish people are occupiers in their own homeland, adding any decision from a judicial body which receives its mandate from the morally bankrupt and politicized UN is completely illegitimate. The UNGA resolution also exposes the hypocrisy of the so-called normalization of some Persian Gulf Arab countries with Israel. The resolution had virtually unanimous support from the Islamic world, including Arab states that have normalized relations with Israel.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The biggest wolf call in modern times has begun in Sweden, as nature organizations warn it could drastically harm the population. The Guardian recently accompanied 200 hunters as they went to kill wolves in the frost-covered forest between Gavleborg and Dalarna, hunting from midnight until the sunset. Activists called the wolf call in Sweden shameful and heartbreaking. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams wrote in this regard, wildlife defenders in Sweden and beyond decried the start of what's being called the largest wolf call in modern times, arguing that killing nearly a fifth of the country's critically endangered lupine population could have grave consequences for biodiversity. Swedish public broadcaster SVT reports hunters in five Swedish countries with the most wolves, Gavleborg, Dalarna, Västmanland, Örebro and Värmland, will be allowed to kill a total of 75 wolves out of a national population of 460 animals. Last winter, Sweden authorized the killing of 27 wolves, while hunters in neighboring Norway had permission to kill 51 wolves, about 60% of the lupine population, and Finland approved the culling of 27 wolves. While Gunnar Gullarsson, the predator manager at the Swedish Hunters Association, says hunting is absolutely necessary to slow the proliferation of wolves, Daniel Ekblom of Sweden's Nature Conservation Society called the call tragic. It could have consequences for a long time to come, Ekblom told SVT. Other opponents of the call noted Sweden's relatively low wolf population. Italy, for example, is only about half as large as Sweden but has around 3,000 wolves, which are strictly protected by law. Wolves, as top predators in the food chain, are a prerequisite for biodiversity, Mary Stigard, president of the anti-hunting group, Jeffrey Kernow, told The Guardian, warning that killing so much of the population through hunting has negative consequences for animals and nature. It's disastrous for the entire ecosystem, she said, adding, the existence of wolves contributes to a richer animal and plant life. Human survival depends on healthy ecosystems. Stigard added, it is obvious that there is a strong political pressure for licensed hunting for wolves and also lynx and bear. There is a large majority of Swedes who like wolves even where they live. In our opinion, the reason for these hunts is simply that there is a demand for shooting wolves among hunters. The hunters' organizations have enormous power in Sweden. It is a fact that the Swedish Parliament has a hunters' club open to members of all parties, with a shooting gallery underneath the parliament. This sounds like a joke, but it's absolutely true. The Swedish Parliament is also lobbying the European Union to remove wolves and bears from its list of species in need of protection. Hanna Dietrich Söderman, who leads the Swedish Environmental Protection Agency's wolf program, says the lupine predators hold a special place in national folklore, evoking primal fears and irrational hatred. There is no other animal that is so easy to both demonize and glorify as the wolf. An imagined fear or hatred has been attached to it, Dietrich Söderman told the local, adding, we have almost made it a symbol of our fearful nature as a whole. It has almost mythical qualities.
Economic divide.
The Chinese President Xi Jinping was in Saudi Arabia recently. What a trip that was, and what a reception he received. At the same time, there were two words that describe the reason for his trip. One, more important for him, the yuan. The other, the dollar. These two went head-to-head, indirectly. How did that happen, and why is that important? That's what we're going to cover in this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in this program, Xi in Saudi Arabia, proposing oil to be paid in the yuan. That is a direct threat to the petrodollar payment system. At the same time, it will weaken the dollar grip on trade. Next, Saudi Arabia's response to Xi Jinping. Well, the Crown Prince agreed to the payment in yuan. China wants to trade also in yuan, aside from oil and gas sales. The U.S. economy, as a result, will be threatened. Next, the U.S. position weakened overall. Why? The move away from the dollar will always weaken the U.S.'s position. And that's what's transpiring. The U.S. counter-reaction? And also, other West Asian nations, will they follow the Saudi lead?